Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Living free.
Welcome to the Living Free Show, 3CR Radio, 855 on your AM dial and 3CR on digital radio. Hi, I'm Bill, and with my co-host...
Mitch, hello.
Mitch. I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and acknowledge that this land was stolen and that sovereignty was never ceded. Each week on the Living Free Show, we showcase one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling and food addictions. Our guests share their recovery story and highlight that shared experience saves lives. Also, please note that Living Free Show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm and family violence. Please consider your own well-being and that of others while listening. My guest today is a drug addict who's recovering with the help of Narcotics Anonymous. So I'd like to welcome Lucy to the show. Hi, Lucy.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Hey, Lucy, what's going on?
So, Lucy, we usually start by talking about childhood and growing up and what led you to take the path you did. So, do you want to talk about your early life and family life and what you were like as a kid?
Sure. So, my family immigrated from the UK when I was, still quite young. I wasn't quite four, and we felt like a really close-knit family. It kind of felt isolating even as a child because we didn't have, that extended family there. But, my mum and dad, they did the best for us that they could with what they had. And, like, my childhood was really good early on. I was a shy, awkward child. I enjoyed things like bird watching, and that kind of thing didn't go down too well at school. I got picked on for that sort of those sorts of interests. So I naturally gravitated towards, the naughty kids because I felt like I could be safe and protected. I do remember being an anxious child. I felt very anxious when my mum would go to work. And I hated going to school in kinder. I remember my mum dropping me off at kinder and hiding under the desk and crying and not wanting to come out because I wanted my mum. I didn't want to, play with the other kids. so I was just an anxious kid from the get-go.
Fair enough. What were the naughty kids into? What were their kind of hobbies?
I don't know. They were more, at that stage, they were more like the bullies. Because I felt like if I stuck around with them and... I wouldn't get picked on because they'd target, unfortunately, the weaker,
vulnerable
people. More vulnerable, yeah. So that's the sort of kids I was hanging out with in school. I did have other friends that weren't bullies that were into more, nerdy topics, hobbies like myself.
Yeah.
But I always gravitated towards the bad kids.
Yeah. So what were the nerdy hobbies?
I liked bird watching. My dad had a field guide of native birds that I actually stole off him as a six-year-old because I wanted to tick off all the birds. And they were just basic birds like pigeons and
although I find it can be pretty in-depth, There are many birds out there what you're looking for.
Absolutely.
So what about family, your brothers and sisters? Did you have any?
Yeah, I've got a younger brother and sister. My sister is about 5 years younger than me. My brother's 3 years younger. I actually didn't really make the effort to get to know them, I guess, because by the time, they were out of their toddler stage,
You'd moved on.
I'd moved on. I'd moved on. And prior to that, my dad had a workplace accident when we were all very young, and he wasn't in the family home for about 2 years while, he was receiving medical treatment. And so there was a lot of chaos in the home. And I think my brother and sister being toddlers and still in nappies, they were top priority, understandably. I feel like I never formed a close bond with my siblings.
Did you feel different as a kid?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did.
I think that's a very common thing with people who have an addiction or a compulsion, is that they feel different and they act different, mm-hmm. and yeah, it all goes from there. Yeah.
And I guess the shyness as well can kind of play into that. You know, yeah. you retreat because of that feeling as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hated like sleepovers with friends, and I remember being invited to stay at one of my friends, her mum's beach house, and like, her mum actually said, no, don't invite Lucy because she'll just cry and want to go home, which was true. so I didn't end up going.
How do you know she said that? Did your friend tell you?
My friend actually told me.
Yeah. Tell you that? Oh,
yeah, she actually told me the truth, which was, you know, I didn't go. I didn't want to go anyway. But
yeah, no.
Yeah.
I like to stay in my room and read books all day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, research birds.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Of course.
Yeah. So were you a good student?
My report cards, I swear they all said Lucy is a smart child, but she needs to apply herself more.
Yeah.
I'd go through phases where I'd do really well, and I was quite an advanced reader for my age. I remember like reading ahead of my age, and being bored at school, so I would act up and hang with the naughty kids and disrupt the class.
Hmm.
So
did that kind of feedback like affect you, knowing that, you know, I guess you had potential according to teachers, but you're not applying yourself?
It didn't affect me then. I didn't really care.
Yeah.
Looking at it now, I just want to give little Lucy a hug. Yeah. But back then I couldn't care less.
Okay.
No. Yeah. 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 did any of your family have any drug or alcohol or gambling problems?
Yeah, my mum, like, I don't want to speak on her behalf because I believe she's listening today, but she would admit freely that, she struggles with alcoholism. She will admit that. My father, he had a dependency on painkillers after his workplace accident. So, like, the genetics are all there. Yeah.
Yeah, and how did that affect the family, that accident as well?
It was horrible. I remember, like, seeing my mum. I don't know, I wanted to help my mum. I was only a child, but, like, I wanted to make it better and I didn't know what to do. And I think part of me thought I had something to do with it.
Yeah,
it was really hard.
Do you think that's the eldest daughter thing, maybe? Like,
maybe, yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So sort of we talked about relationships and things, but did things change when you went to secondary school?
Yes.
Yeah. So what changed?
So I'd already been stealing alcohol from my mum and dad. I tried cigarettes by then, by high school. High school just gave me access to like more naughty kids, more of the bad kids by then, more access to drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
And so I smoked marijuana, I think, for the first time in year 7, so by the time I was 12.
Yep.
So that's what changed. I just had more access to the things I was already sort of dabbling with, like alcohol, and that led to drugs.
Yeah. Okay. So what sort of drugs did you start with then, apart from marijuana?
It was marijuana for a long time until I turned 18, when I was introduced to heroin.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you feel like marijuana kind of gave you at the time?
To be honest with you, I didn't actually like it that much, but I kept doing it because it sort of numbed me. So I didn't... A big part of my problem was my mind was always racing.
Right.
And it slowed that down, which I did like. I did like that effect. So when heroin was presented to me, I didn't really say no.
Yeah. Do you find there was similarities between the two, or it offered something different, heroin?
Different.
Yeah.
Very different. Yeah. I can't put words to it, but I knew the first time, like, this wasn't going to end well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was that first time like for you?
I've heard people talk about heroin, like, being a warm hug from their mum, and, like, that's what it was for me that first time. Like, it felt like that warm hug from my mother, but that didn't last because I wanted to feel that again, and I spent 20 years trying to feel that again, and I never did.
So is that the trajectory? I mean, so it's like that with alcohol,
mm-hmm.
that eventually alcohol turns against you, and you can never achieve that feeling.
Yeah.
So is it the same with drugs?
Turned against me.
Yeah.
It became my reason for living. I would wake up, I'd need to have it or I'd be sick. I'd have to get it before work. You know, I'd arrange to get it on my lunch break, arrange to get it more when I got home. At one stage, I was working three jobs just to, because I prided myself on being an honest addict. So I you know, would pay for all my drugs. So I worked three jobs. Like one was an admin job, one was cleaning, and one was just delivering pamphlets. But that was still money. That was my life. Like, that was my existence, was just getting enough money to be able to, and getting drugs. Like, that was it.
Yeah.
Nothing.
So did the drugs affect your work?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I was erratic. Yeah. I couldn't hold down a job at all. I was angry. I was either angry because I was withdrawing or the job was getting in the way of me getting high. I was just an angry person, and I blamed my employers every time. I would often go out to lunch and not come back. Like, that's how I left my jobs. Yeah. 6 months was probably the longest I managed to hold down a job for.
Yeah.
And what do you think it is about honesty that you wanted to pride yourself on as an addict?
I didn't want to ever steal from anyone. Like, I didn't want to be one of those addicts that stole, which I did in the end, by the way.
But you tried.
Yeah, I tried. I tried not to. Tried to be honest, but...
Yeah.
But honesty wasn't a part of your character, though.
No, it wasn't. I was just honest from the beginning. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like you realise that and you wanted to do something about it. Yeah.
I'm going to overcompensate and so I'll work three jobs to pay for it.
Yeah, okay. So things changed when you turned 18. So do you want to talk about what that transition was like?
Yeah. So I met an older boy who lived on the other side of the city. I lived in the Yarra Valley with my parents and he lived in Sunbury. And I'd become such a wrecking ball at that stage that my mum sort of pushed me, like, in that direction.
Suggested.
Suggested. That's the word. Suggested. And I understand that. I had a younger brother and sister. Like, I was behaving in really harmful ways.
Yeah.
And I was happy to go because I knew when I met him that he was addicted to heroin. And there was a part of me, inside of me, that was excited about that fact. Because I knew where it was going to lead me. And,
And do you want to talk about how that relationship unfolded?
Yeah, sure. So, like, he, at his core, is a really lovely human. But being addicted to heroin... it was never going to end well. It was a very, very toxic relationship. And I took full advantage of him. He lived with his parents and they allowed me to move in. And basically they provided for me for almost a decade, I would say.
Wow. Yeah.
So
that's commitment.
Yeah.
And knowing about the addiction, did
I feel like looking back now, I came in like a tornado and I just basically took them hostage. Like I'd done to my own family before that.
Yeah, they felt like they had to almost care for you. Yeah. Like,
So did they understand the nature of addiction?
I don't think so. Like they'd seen their own son struggle with addiction for years.
Yeah.
And I don't think they fully understood it. I don't think so, no.
Yeah. Because I think that families become enablers because they don't understand the mechanism and the illness.
Right.
And so they're trying to help the person, but it means keeping them addicted. Yeah.
How was your using? How did that develop over the 10 years that you were there? Or I guess both of you guys?
It was just a daily 24/7 thing. It was all I did with my life until I couldn't hold down a job.
Yeah.
That was just my life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, we're probably up for a break.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
This is the Living Free Show on 3CR, 855 kilohertz on your AM dial and 3CR on digital radio. If you'd like to listen to one of our many podcasts, then you can find us on your preferred podcast platform or just Google 3CR Living Free and check out our website. You can also contact us via phone or email. Today I'm talking with Lucy about drug addiction and recovery through the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. Lucy, we sort of ended with you talking about being in a relationship using heroin. And you also mentioned that you spent a lot of time using heroin.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you used the words 24 hours. So do you want to sort of take us through a day in the life of a heroin user?
Sure. I'm trying to think back to those days.
Throwback.
Yeah, not that long ago, but So I'd usually wake up feeling sick, like they say, like, I've heard it described as like a bad flu in movies, but it's different. It's like I'm exhausted, but I also want to tear my skin off and jump out of my skin at the same time. And like sometimes I didn't have the strength to even stand. I'd have to crawl across the floor to get to the toilet or get water.
So probably worse than a bad flu then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say so. In my experience. Then, you know, a phone call would be made really early before work to my dealer at the time. And hopefully, you know, I could get some to get me going before work because I would not have saved any from the night before.
Was your dealer, like, accessible? Was he close? Like,
he was close. He wasn't always accessible. So sometimes I would have to go to work feeling like death. I would be raging on the way to work on those mornings, like driving erratically and cutting in and out and getting in a lot of road rage. And I'd turn up to work. I'd try, you know, if I hadn't been able to get it that morning, you know, I'd try again for lunchtime. In fact, even if I had had it, I'd often go off and get more at lunchtime anyway. It wouldn't be long before the withdrawal started if I did have it. It'd be a matter of hours. Hence the, you know, the morning phone call to the dealer, the lunchtime phone call, and then again in the evening. And I'd always tell myself that I would save some or I wouldn't have as much, but that wasn't the case. I needed more and more each time.
So how do you understand how much you need? What's the process?
Really, there is no process.
Yeah.
In the beginning, it was about trying to feel, you know, that warm hug from mum again.
Yeah.
In towards, you know, not long after that, it becomes about not being sick.
It's trying to ward off.
Trying to ward off the sickness.
Yeah. How did alcohol interact with, you know, withdrawals and with your usage at that time?
They complemented each other really well. It wasn't enough to combat the withdrawals, but I could black out on alcohol. Which was useful at the time. When I was withdrawing, I could still black out on alcohol, so I found that to be useful at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So did your alcohol use and drug use complement each other? I think you've said they have, but
they did back then. Yep. When I was, you know, just using heroin, when it became about other drugs like ice.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when did you make the transition to ice?
So I'd been using stimulants for a while, but I think I'd written my life off pretty badly. by the time I discovered ice, which was only maybe like 5 years ago. And I knew what ice would do for me. I didn't want to exist anymore, and I just knew that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't because of other stimulant use. You kind of knew what how it would feel.
Yeah. That as well. Like, that was alluring. But I think I was on such a downward trajectory. I just wanted to speed the process up. And I didn't care what I was putting in my body anymore and what I was doing to myself. Mm. So I was willing to just consume everything and anything.
Yeah. That's the thing that always surprises me when drug addicts talk about just taking whatever there is. And it's like, oh, my God, like, that'd scare me to death.
Yeah. Do you remember the first time that you did ice, what that was like?
Yeah. It was really scary, actually. I remember standing in my bathroom. I did it in front of my bathroom mirror. I smoked it. And I actually remember looking at myself in the mirror. Like, it was a really surreal experience. And I actually remember thinking in my head, like, you're done for. Like,
Yeah, not quite. Well, I guess it's a high in a sense, but it's...
Yeah, it was a high. And I think the fact that the high was so strong, it scared me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Scared you. Yeah.
Yeah, it did.
Okay. So as you're using progressed and into ice, so how did that affect your ability to get a job or keep a job?
Things just got worse from there. I couldn't keep a job. I got by. I don't know how I got by. I think my parents were sending me a lot of money. I remember lying to my dad and calling him and telling him I'd been robbed, but I hadn't, just so I could get more. I was just scamming people. Like, I survived that way for maybe a good 2 to 3 years. Like, I didn't have to really work because I could just lie to get what I wanted.
Yeah. I guess before, when you were discussing wanting to be an honest addict, it's taken a turn from there.
It did. It took a sharp turn.
So what's it like scamming people? Like, what's the mental process?
Do you know, at the time, I didn't even think of them.
Yep.
There wasn't a mental process. In fact, I got resentful and angry if they dared turn me down. I'm like, when I lied to my dad and said I'd been robbed, that was like one of the only times he'd like said no and didn't send me money, because he knew by then that I was full of it. Mm. But I was so angry that he didn't believe me, because even though it was a lie, I'd convinced myself it was real. And I'm like, how dare this man not help his daughter who's just been robbed?
Yeah.
Like, that's the mental process.
Yeah. Denial. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. Do you think, like, psychosis was maybe part of that at the time, or
not quite? Not at that stage. It did come in.
Yeah.
It did come in. Came into the picture maybe 2 years after using ice. I started believing some really outlandish things. Like, the CIA was communicating with me telepathically, which saw me, strapped to a gurney in a hospital and put in a padded cell. And I didn't know they were real, but they do exist.
Yeah. Mm. So what's it like coming to in that situation? That must be pretty terrifying.
It's terrifying, especially because I believed that it was real and that these people in the hospital were working with the CIA against me.
Yeah.
So it was terrifying.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you're trapped in there.
I'm trapped.
They're going to get you. They've got you.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
So coming out of that then, was there any sort of consequences for your relationship if you'd gone into a psychosis? Yeah.
You mean like my mental health or?
Yeah. Well, I guess you're just talking about.
Oh, with my.
With your partner. Yeah. So what happened there?
So I did skip a big chunk there. So by that stage, we'd parted ways, but I was still using him for, basically took him hostage again, and would just use him for a place to stay. So he at that stage had been letting me. I say letting, he wasn't letting me. I'd just made his home my home and I was staying there. So when I was released from the hospital, I think that stay I'd only been kept for 3 days. So I was still unwell and I went straight back to the house and in a psychotic state.
Yep.
And I did hold him at knife point with the intention to kill him. I thought he was working with the CIA.
Yep.
So
right.
In my mind, I had to kill him.
Yeah, of course.
Wow. Yep. So how did that end?
He called my mum in tears because he believed I really was going to kill him, and I probably was. My mum suggested he call the police, which was the best thing that could have happened, not just for him, for myself. I got sent to Dame Phyllis Frost Center, which is a maximum security women's prison. I think I was there for just over a month. In that time, it gave me a chance to reset, get the ice out of my system. I did not know if I would be released back into the public anytime soon. I'd been denied bail the first time I applied for it, so in my mind, you know, I thought I'd be stuck there for years. The first part of my stay, I think there was like 3 weeks or so where they had to have me in solitary confinement because I was so unwell. I was really aggressive. And by the fourth week, I'd been released back into the general population, with the general population. And a girl came up to me in there and asked if I wanted to go to a 12-step meeting, which is like an NAAA next meeting. And I mustn't have been in psychosis at that point. Like something, like there was some clarity. Something got through to me and I said yes. Went against everything, like every fiber of my being, but like this little voice in the back of my head just told me I had to say yes to this girl.
Yeah. So, and do you know why she kind of asked you or made that offer to you? Because
So she was just going around talking to all the girls in the prison. I know now that she was carrying the message. She was sharing her experience in a 12-step fellowship from the inside.
Yep.
And that's what she was doing with the girls there. And I just happened to be one of the girls in her path that day. She came to carry the message to me. And for some reason, somehow, and I'm getting emotional thinking about it, somehow I listened and I went to that meeting.
Yeah. So what was the impact of the meeting on you?
For the first time in my life, I felt that there were people that understood how I felt. And I saw something in them that I wanted for myself. I saw, like, I don't know, they seemed shiny in a way. Like, they had, like, this glow and I wanted it. I wish I could say that I left the prison because I did get released on a corrections order. I wish I could say I left and didn't pick up again. But I did have a few more months of crashing and bashing to do. But that meeting really left an impression because, you know, I remember rocking up to an appointment with my corrections worker. My condition was I had to go and check in once a week. And I was really, really drunk. And I just rocked up to the appointment and I told her that I was drunk. I couldn't stop drinking. I needed some help. Could you help me get into rehab? And the corrections organised for me to go to rehab.
Wow, that's terrific. Yeah. Okay, we'll take another break there.
If you're experiencing family violence, free legal support is available. You may need support with obtaining protection, setting up safe parenting arrangements, organising a new visa, getting into safe housing, or making sure bills and bank accounts are split fairly. Community legal centres have expertise in helping people who experience family violence and can provide confidential advice to help you understand your rights and legal options. Reach out today for guidance and support. Visit www.fclc.org.au and click Get Help to find a community legal centre near you. You don't have to face family violence alone. If you are currently in crisis, please contact Safe Steps on 1800 015 188. Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You are what you eat.
Local Food Connections interviews with food producers, backyard growers and urban farmers. Join us every Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on 3CR Community Radio 855 on your AM dial, on 3CR Digital Radio and live streaming on 3cr.org.au/streaming. Local Food Connections, a show about the importance of local food in sustainable communities.
Goes from dust to dust, gotta just trust that upper crust, that maintain that good terrain from whence you came.
Hi, this is the Living Free Show on 3CR Digital Radio. live streaming on 3cr.org.au. And today we're talking with Lucy, and we're talking about drug addiction and recovery through Narcotics Anonymous. So, Lucy, you talked about being shown, I guess, an example of a different way of life through 12-step fellowships, and had the opportunity to go into rehab. So do you want to talk about that transition into rehab from being on a corrections order, I guess, and how your life changed at that point?
Sure. When I got into rehab, I was really desperate at that point. I knew that something had to change. The reason I'd actually gone into corrections that day and begged for help to get into rehab is, like, a few days prior, I'd actually perpetrated some family violence against my mother. And I didn't love myself. I hated myself at that stage, but I loved my mum. And I remember the fear in her eyes, and I knew something had to change. And I decided even if I couldn't do it for myself at that point, I would do it for my mum, for my family.
Yep. So
I was really relieved to have rehab, to just not have to fight, not have to fight anything and everyone. You know, I was relieved. The amazing thing about rehab is, you know, the first night in there, doesn't matter how fresh you are, how cooked you are, the first thing they do is take you to a meeting. So, you know, within a couple of hours of being in rehab, I got taken to an NA meeting, which is just down the road from my house. And it felt like coming home. Mm. There was a lot of broken people in the room.
Yeah.
But I could relate. I could identify. And there was some hope. I heard some messages of hope in that room, and I could see that recovery was a thing, because in my world, I didn't know you could recover from drug addiction. I thought that's just what you did until you died.
Yeah.
And I saw some recovery, and it gave me a lot of hope. And that really drove me throughout rehab.
Yeah. So what's it like to see fellow addicts who are recovering as a user?
It's amazing. I can't even articulate it, but just to see people recover from such a hopeless state and just see that light come back on.
Yeah.
Sometimes I've seen them come into recovery and there's no light behind their eyes. Like, they're dead behind the eyes.
Yeah.
There's a girl I actually went to rehab with who came in like that, and I see her regularly at the local NA meeting, that first one they ever took me to, and like that light is back behind her eyes, and she's got that glow, that shine that I saw in prison. Like, yeah, she's got that, and I've been able to watch that unfold in real time, and that's just amazing.
Yeah, it must be fulfilling.
It is.
Yeah. I think that's one of the good things about recovery, is watching people come in after you and see the same.
Yeah, absolutely.
See that happen, yeah. So do you want to talk about, I guess, the impression it had on you and how long it took you before you could start looking at your own life honestly?
Yeah. I wish I could say that I got it right away. Like, and I did, like, in the sense that I didn't pick up a drink or drug again.
Yep.
But what I didn't get was the honesty side of things. Mm-hmm.
Which is something you've wrestled with over the years.
I have, which I've been in huge denial about. So I did the steps. I went through the steps. I got a sponsor and went through them while I was still in rehab, and I finished, the last few steps, maybe a month out of rehab.
Yep.
I did my step 4, which is, you know, make a fearless and thorough moral inventory, which I didn't do. I held back so many things. I lied about so many things. And I also spun a lot of narratives.
Yep.
I just couldn't look at myself. I still wasn't willing to look at myself. So I sat in a lot of pain until just recently. I've just done it again, step 4 again, and I've done it properly this time. I've been able to actually look at myself and, you know, admit a lot of things that I thought I would take to my grave. But I haven't had to. I've been able to find someone I trust that I can share that with. And, I didn't feel judged. I felt loved. And at the end of it, she got up and gave me a hug. She's my sponsor. And she said, God forgives you. And I really needed to hear that.
Yeah. It's it's that feeling that I didn't know what I was doing. I was doing it because I felt I had to survive.
Yeah.
And now I understand that it wasn't
right.
It wasn't appropriate, but yeah.
Yeah.
And just being able to see my part in it. What did I do? What could I have done differently that I didn't do? And look at what I did do and go, well, I'm the one. It's not somebody else.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was really freeing to be able to look at myself like that.
And what do you think kind of enabled that for you to finally make that moral inventory in an honest way?
I got in enough pain and I knew that continuing to be dishonest would only lead me back to a drug or a drink. And that would mean death, or I could harm someone else. And I don't want that. And I knew I had to get really honest.
Yeah, okay. It was for your mum at first and that transitioned to doing it for yourself.
Yeah, now it's for me. But in the beginning, it was about my mum. I couldn't show up for myself. But now...
you can.
I've learned to love myself, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think it was step four that you... Was it step four, the moral inventory? Do you think that's the step you struggled with the most, or if any?
I wouldn't say... Look, I can struggle with all of them. Like, even step one, I have to surrender every day. Like, if I don't wake up and surrender, like, first thing, my alcoholism's untreated every morning when I wake up. Oh, sorry, my addiction.
Sure,
I identify as both.
Yeah.
I have to surrender and treat it every day.
Yeah.
But I can struggle with all of the steps.
I think that's part of it, I guess.
Yeah.
You've got your rest of your life to...
Yeah.
Nail it. So being an NA then sort of comes with a responsibility to help others. So how's that work in your life?
Look, early days, I've got to be really honest. I thought I was helping others, but I wasn't. Very selfish individual. By nature, I am selfish.
Yep.
It's only recently where I've really understood the meaning of being useful and being of service and showing up for others. And that's been a game changer as well, because I spend a lot of my recovery in my own head and telling my first sponsor that I was helping others and getting out there and making phone calls. But really I was sitting on my bed in a dark room vaping, which I don't vape anymore. But, so to actually genuinely get off my backside and get to meetings and talk to newcomers, make phone calls. I've just started sponsoring a couple of women, just thinking of other people and not myself. It's really shifted my recovery for the better.
Yeah, because I think the other thing is once you try and share your recovery, it helps you to put your own recovery in perspective and what's important and what they need to know. You're sort of thinking about them, but trying to explain it, you've got to know it yourself.
Absolutely. It did. It forced me to pick up my game and actually get recovery.
Yep.
I actually have to have recovery to be able to talk recovery. So that's been a game changer.
Yeah, that's right. It's part of the honesty bit. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I didn't have much recovery prior to the last few months.
And coming on the show, that's a... It shows commitment to sharing,
Absolutely.
Yeah, which is great. Yeah. So we talked a little bit about family violence and you were mentioning that you're the perpetrator of family violence. So did you want to talk about, I guess, the perception that women don't do it?
Yeah. So I found that really hard. I perpetrated a lot of family violence while I was drugging. I think at one stage I had maybe four IVOs out on me. And a lot of my charges and convictions are family violence based, domestic violence based, against my parents, against partners who are men. What I struggled with is there seems to be a stigma around men and family violence, which means there's also a lot of programs to help rehabilitate men that want to, you know, get better, or whether it's court ordered or whatever. Yeah. For women, there really don't seem to be as many programs. I know when I was on my corrections orders, I didn't have any behavior change or family violence programs that I had to do. There was no programs for me. So I think there's less help available to women who want to, you know, change.
And so do you think that affected your recovery or your ability to recover?
You know, I think I've been able to, luckily because I have a 12-step program, I've been able to make the behavior change thanks to the program.
Like
my sponsor always says that, you know, the 12-step program, it's the ultimate behavior change program, and she's not wrong.
Yeah.
If I didn't have a program, then I wouldn't have recovered in any sense of the word. I wouldn't only be using drugs, but I'd still be a violent, aggressive person. But having this program, it's enabled me to actually make genuine changes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We were talking before, and I mentioned that Al-Anon Family Groups, you know, as a son of an alcoholic, my behaviour was not aggressive, but it wasn't passive. It was, you know, it wasn't nice behaviour towards somebody who was suffering from alcoholism. And coming to a fellowship where you learn respect for other people really helps tone down that aggression.
Absolutely.
And the anger, and you realize everybody else has got their problems.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's taught me a lot of understanding and tolerance.
Yeah. Yeah.
How's your relationship with your parents improved since your recovery, since you've been doing recovery?
I have a really good relationship with my parents today. Which I'm really grateful for, because there was a time where I didn't think they would ever talk to me again. My mum's listening today. Hi, Mum. Yeah, my relationship with them is better than it's ever been. Like, I feel I'm grateful to be an addict, a recovered addict, because I feel like I'm the best version of myself today. And I wouldn't have the relationship with my parents that I have now if it wasn't for recovery and a 12-step fellowship and a 12-step program. And
yeah, that's amazing. I also had a question. You know, you mentioned before about wanting to give little Lucy a hug.
Yeah.
You know, are there any messages that you would give her as well? Any advice for a younger version of yourself?
Honestly, just be honest and ask for help.
Yeah, two big ones.
I think it's the asking for help. That's the sticking point always. It's that feeling that if I ask for help, I must be admitting that I'm not good enough or I can't cope.
Right.
When really that's it.
It's actually the opposite almost. It's that you're good enough to actually be accountable for yourself. To ask for help.
You're worth saving.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, being discarded. It's a sad thing. So we have NAs on the show occasionally, and we'd like to have more. So because we think it's important to spread the message about all recovery fellowships, and having an NA guest is really good. So we'd like to thank you for coming in today and helping us spread the message about Narcotics Anonymous and how well it helps people.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Lucy.
We've still got a bit of time, so we'll continue talking. I'll just mention, if you'd like to talk to somebody or would like more information about Narcotics Anonymous, you can call them on 1-300-652-820 at any time, or you can go online at navic.net.au. So, Lucy, one thing I want to talk about just in the end is relationships. So are you able to form close relationships now?
Yeah.
You know, do you feel you're ready to get back in touch with people?
It's funny you ask that, because I was talking to my sponsor last night about the fact I've kept everyone at arm's length still, but I've just let another member into my life And by that, I mean I call her a friend, and I actually mean that. And it's the first time I can actually say I have a friend, which sounds sad.
Yeah.
That it has allowed me to start trusting people. I think I kept people at arm's length because I thought everyone was out to get me. But having, you know, being part of a fellowship, it's taught me to trust again. Yeah.
And it sounds like a pretty valuable friendship for you as well.
It is very valuable friendship. Mm. Very valuable.
Yeah. So work-wise then, are you able to get back into work?
I'm working currently.
Yeah.
I've been working at the same place for almost a year, which is like my record.
Wow.
Nice.
And I actually was honest with them today and applied for leave and didn't just walk out at lunch so I could come here.
You do a one-year anniversary kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right?
So, no, I enjoy working there. I have a good rapport with my colleagues. And
Yeah, that's good.
Awesome. Yeah. I just wanted to ask a little bit about being a sponsor kind of you know, with the perspective of your recovery and really having it kind of sink in over the last couple of months, what is it like for you as a sponsor kind of ongoing?
So I've only really like just properly started sponsoring women. Like literally in the last month, I had two women approach me. I had done it earlier on in recovery. I couldn't show up for them the way they needed, and they changed sponsors, which I totally, I'm glad they did because it's life and death.
Yeah, it's important.
This time feels different. Like I've shown up to, you know, step work with them. I've been able to be there for them, take their calls, call them back if I can't answer. Whereas last time I was still selfish, and it's taught me not to be selfish.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Considerate of others and their needs. Yep. Okay. Well, I think we can probably finish. So that's about all we've got time for today. So I'd like to thank Lucy for sharing her story of drug dependence with us and talking about how involvement with Narcotics Anonymous helps during recovery. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Cheers, Lucy.
I hope you'll be able to join us again next week when Anne will be talking about the impact of family disease of alcoholism and the recovery journey for family members in Al-Anon family groups. Coming up next, we've got Balanoir, The Spirit of Wah, hosted by Uncle Talgum Choco Edwards. Join Uncle Choco in The Spirit of Wah on a journey of belonging and movement through singalongs and yarns. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned now for more Radical Radio on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.